get real with you. Real guys talk real sports. We will. Ray, Marcus, game changer. Start to get real. These are the kind of guys I need to have in the locker room. The championship type guys. Certain guys, you just got to recognize, I got to pay the money. I got to keep it. Everybody has an opinion.
They came with so much bravado and so much swagger.
We'll make excuses. We're not going to make excuses. Sometimes you got to create space where there's no space.
I can't argue with LeBron with this.
I do have a bit of a problem with execution. Right?
He burned a lot of bridges. He's going to be hated in Chicago. He's going to be hated in Cleveland. He's going to be hated in New York. And that's what I'm excited to see.
Now, I blame it on Nintendo. I blame it on the fact that they never played against a team that's going to be as dominant as this team could be.
The true villain team. The team that everybody wants to smack in the mouth every time they play them.
All right, all right, all right. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports. Marcus the Game Changer in the house. Got my man D Wheels on the line.
What's up? What's up?
So, you know, we've been gone for a little bit, but we back. You know, it's been a long time. We shouldn't have left you, but you know, we back. Back at our usual Tuesday night slots, 10 to 12. Glad that you're here to join us.
That's right.
Glad you're here to spend some time with us, talk a little bit of sports. You know, we're going to pull up to the table and we're going to jump right into it. There's a lot been going on since the last time you heard from us. So we're going to get all caught up and give our opinion on everything. And hopefully, you know, you call in and join in the conversation. If you want to do that, feel free. The Real Sports Guys, the number is 1-347-989-0844. Feel free to call in and get on with the Real Sports Guys. We greatly appreciate it. All that we ask is that you do not come weak. Because if you come weak, you will get the Mutombo finger. Okay? You get the finger waved at you. We don't play that. So, you know, we always start the show off with a segment we like to call the Funky Editorial. That's just where we go in and give our opinion, kind of editorialize over the airwaves, pontificate, if you will. Over something that, you know, was interesting or something that it just kind of is sticking in our craw. You know, it's just sticking in our craw a little bit. Guys a little irritated, guys a little aggravated. So, you know, we want to share our opinion with the people and see how you feel about our opinion, how you feel about the event itself, and get your feedback on it. So we're going to get into that real quick.
One thing we need to say. Shall we say it, y'all? Melvin, Jimmy, Coleman, Ryan, say it. Everybody wanna get funky one more time.
All right, so I'm gonna set this up real quick, and then we're just gonna get into it. Then. We got a fucking dog in the background. dog made his way up. Be quiet. We got a barking dog in the background. He obviously want to get in on the conversation too. But with this whole, you know, we had the NFL playoffs in full swing. You know, playoffs wrapped up. We to the Super Bowl, last two teams. And, you know, we're in the thick of the Midwest. We're in the heart of the Midwest, for those that don't know. You know, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. D's in Rockford, Illinois. And so we got, I'm in Packer country. He's in Bear country. And it's been intense up here the last couple of weeks. Building up to this game. Once the final buzzer sounded on those divisional playoff games and the matchup was set, it was war up here. The last week has been crazy, and it climaxed this Sunday. And the Packers came out victorious. And the Bears fans are a little confused. They seem a little hurt, a little bit of butt hurt in Bear Nation. they dissing their quarterback. They don't know. You know, I'm seeing pictures of Cutler on the internet with a skirt on. You know, I got people sending me all types of pictures of Cutler in compromising positions. Have the Bear fans turned on Cutler? Is it justified? What's your take on it?
I've been living in this area a long time, and extra probably Philadelphia and maybe New York fans, Chicago fans overreact one way or another, take it too far to the left or too far to the right on this issue. But it was so heated, and people wanted it so bad, you know, given that these teams hadn't met in this situation for years, you know. You know, went back to when was that? Back in the 30s, 20s?
1941. Yeah. It's been a long time.
It's been a long time since they met. So it was all built up. And, you know, it raised a big issue about this whole idea of, and what people are bringing on is this posture, this mannerisms, it's the body language, and it's, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, he does, I mean, that's something that he's got to live with, because he does look, you know, like he's not always in it. You know, but I always view sports as production. You know, are you trying to produce? If you're not producing, then you got to be accountable for that. If not, then whatever. So whatever style you take, there's an up and a down to it. There's some people who talk too much, you know, like Ocho or somebody like that, but some people talk too little. You know, people are never satisfied with how you come at it. But at the end of the day, production wins out. And what it was in the biggest moment, he wasn't there to be found fighting. He had a Scottie Pippen. It looked like he had a Scottie Pippen migraine. And that's part of the Chicago culture. It's like every time they get close, because football is king. You can talk, everybody knows Jordan won all their championships, but the most popular dude in Chicago was Mike Ditka. When he was coaching, like Mike Ditka watching, Mike Ditka owns Chicago. So Chicago football, the Bears, that's Chicago. And to get that close and lose to the rivals and to watch Rodgers get crushed by Peppers and then get up, stick his tongue out, bleed, do whatever you do and still play, and then your quarterback is standing on the sideline, not on crutches, not on. They would have been better off just walking into the locker room, not having him on the sideline. You know, killed, because if you can stand, you can play. And that's what I think the biggest issue was, his peers threw gasoline on him. And I heard somebody, you know, you and I are both fans of sports talk radio. We listen across the airways. You know, someone brought up a real good comment today was, it's not about whether or not he was hurt or not, or can play or not, or whether he's tough or not. You know, I think people who are close to him say he's tough as they get. I think there's enough people who have been communicating that. But it was the fact that peers, the fraternity, that usually doesn't say much, came out in such the way that they did on this guy. They didn't give him the benefit of the doubt. So that was the biggest thing, that the folks who are in the fraternity were okay. You know, somebody like Jones Drew, who himself had an injury and missed the last two games of the season, when they really needed those games to win, was talking junk. That right there, I think, is what Cutler's got to battle. That right there is what helps and justifies these Bears fans who are sending you emails and send you all these things about that. Because they just say, look, his own fraternity is calling on the way we are justified. And I haven't seen too much, not even with Danny and Thomason when he got hurt. Not too many people came out and questioned him like this when he was sitting on the sideline and not back in the game. You know, there's something about Cutler that just is like a lightning rod. And for him, he got to figure out whether or not he cares enough to address it, change it, or not. If he's going to be who he is, he's going to have to perform. That's going to be his biggest thing he got to do. He got to perform. His biggest problem is you can't be cocky or you can't be the way you are and not perform. And that's the part he got to live with. You can be who you want to be, but you better perform. And in Chicago is the biggest place when it comes to performance. If you perform, you are a king forever in a place like Chicago. You ain't got to win that many. You just can win one.
Yeah.
And love you forever. And that's, he's a lightning rod. I've never seen anybody like this draw these kind of reactions that I've seen from Cutler ever.
Yeah, see, and I agree. I agree with your take on how his peers threw gasoline on the fire. And I have a different perspective on the whole fan hate though. And I think the reason I do is because I feel like there was a perfect storm. There was a perfect storm of quite a few elements that kind of came into play that created such a visceral reaction from the fans. Where you got people burning his jersey. I mean, and fans, is that the new thing? Anytime you disheartened with a cat, you just gonna go out and burn his jersey. You know what I mean? Like, come on. You pay for it. You can do whatever you want, but let's be real. Come on now. Come on. Okay, it was funny with the LeBron thing, but if this is going to be the trend, it's dumb. All right, let's just stop burning cats jerseys. It's not that serious. But, getting back to my point, is that you had a couple things at play. Okay, you had, again, the biggest game for the franchise in quite some time. The first time that they went into this game with a legitimate franchise-type quarterback. So, you know, you have a franchise that is quarterback-starved, that's basically had a revolving door at the quarterback position and is looking for somebody to be that person to man that position, hold that position down for an extended period of time. They thought that they had that guy in Cutler. Then you have, this is the biggest game for the franchise against their biggest rival to go to the Super Bowl. And then you have who Cutler is on top of all of that. And so this is one of those situations where how you perform in this situation, either way it goes, you're unfairly going to be cemented in the fan base's memory as either a clutch, step up in the big game type of guy, whether you're that guy at all. If Cutler had walked away and played well in this game, Bear fans would have loved him. He would have gotten a free pass to do a whole bunch of garbage in Chicago for a little bit. You know what I mean? He would have been given a little bit of leeway to be me, because they was going to point back to the NFC Championship game where he balled out against the Packers. Conversely, if you play poorly in that same game, in that same situation, you're unfairly going to get beat on. You're unfairly going to get stepped on, and you're unfairly going to get viewed as a choke artist or gutless, or in this case, you not having any heart or being afraid to get back out on the field. Fairly or unfairly, it's the circumstances of the situation from a fan perspective. Now, yeah, his peers weighing in on it. I think he's also probably rubbed people around the league in the wrong way, and that's why, you know, I think people have that reaction to him. His peers had that reaction to him that they did. I think with fans, they were hurt. They were hurt because they put a lot of stock in him being the guy. He was going to be the one that changed it. You know, he was going to be the one that turned things around. You know, this was going to be that time where they got it right, where they had that guy. You know, they've gone against teams year after year with this also runs at the quarterback position. And this was going to be that guy who was going to step up and win that game for him. And he looked horrible. Regardless of whether he was hurt or not, he was not great when he was in. And then the fact that he stood on the sidelines, it more than anything, it hurt the fans' heart. I think Bear fans are just hurt. You know, I don't know if they'll get over it or not, but I think what happened was that idea that they had a franchise guy who was going to step up in the clutch and make those throws that they see Peyton Manning and Tom Brady and Drew Brees and the Aaron Rodgers-type quarterbacks make, they have that guy anymore. And that hurts, and they're angry because they bought in. They bought into it, and they thought that they had that guy. And I think all year they weren't sure if he was that guy. You know, I grew up in Chicago, so I have a lot of family from Chicago. They weren't quite sure. They weren't quite sold on Cutler. They wasn't quite sold on Cutler. They didn't know what they had, and this was a chance to see what they had. And I think they just feel bad about what they saw. They feel bad. They feel hurt about what they saw because it reeked of the same old, same old. It reeked of everything that they had gone through over the last 15 years, you know, where they have had guys constantly switching in at that position. And I think that's why, from the fan perspective, you're getting that reaction out of Chicago. It's just because I think Bear fans are just they're just disheartened right now because they didn't see that fire, they didn't see that leadership, they didn't see that fight in their quarterback, and this is a guy who they thought was going to give them that.
And I think, one thing that you hit really hard, and as you were speaking, this is also the Midwest where we also spent a lot of time watching Brett Favre going on and off the field, then they're being carried off the field and coming back. Holding his blood, and his, you know what I'm saying? All those images, and you're standing on the sidelines and you can bite. That it's not too long ago, even though it was a crash and burn season for him, they would basically literally drag him off the field with everything. And I think that's what, and you don't, and for Cutler, the thing he's got to think about is, Dan Marino went to a Super Bowl as a rookie or second year rookie, and then never went back again. So you don't have too many options when you get that close.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the part that he has to think about. And you know, it's a strange, Ron Jaworski said, that injury with the tear into his career. So, a couple people, somebody came out with something today saying that. Part of the reaction that he also has in terms of his demeanor is the fact he has type 1 diabetes. And part of it is not being too high or being too low is part of managing because your levels go up and down constantly through a game. And so you can't, as somebody, you can't get too emotional or too stressed or too whatever because those levels go up and down. There's a lot of reasons. So his biggest issue, I think, for him, there's a couple of things. The Bears were so, and the fans, and this is where I struggle with Chicago fans, because anybody who knows football knows that they were doing offensively with smoke and mirrors. Because if you really evaluate that offense, they got a championship defense. They got a subpar offense on every measure, other than the two people who carried them are the two bright spots. And the third one is just isolated because the offense doesn't really feature it. Which is Olsen, but really Forte and Cutler because he has at least the skill set at offense. But if you really think about the structure of the offense, the weakest part of the offense, and you and I know, if you're a Bears fan, you understand the Fink philosophy. That's what got you the championship. You win championships on Napoleon and all these guys who are great GMs know it on the offense and defensive line from the inside out. And you make it, you build your strength right up the middle. They've always done that, right? If you look at the Bears' offense, other than Cruz, I mean, they've got a pretty weak offensive line. No number one receiver, really. And you got an offense like they had with Mike Marsh, and then you got the Mad Genius who ran a reverse on the goal line. A crucial play. I mean, even though they got the first string quarterback up there, if you look at what they had going into the game, the first string quarterback was throwing the ball, moving it there, running the football. He runs a reverse to Bennett in a crucial play. They call a timeout and he come out running reverse. So they're really be mad at. That's what makes me mad about Chicago fans because you're supposed to know Chicago, Philly. Y'all supposed to be the fans that know football. Y'all supposed to be deeper than that. Y'all ain't supposed to be embarking in the LeBron stuff. Y'all supposed to know this better than that. And for y'all to behave the way y'all behave, y'all got to look a little deeper than that. Your offense, if you do the grade right, the only place, the two places where you can, your defense is on par with Green Bay. You got championship defense. The special teams was probably better. But offensively, there was a major gap. You knew that going into the game. And yeah, Cutler got hurt, he didn't play well, but you already done, you already had one foot in the grave. Cutler, the reason, how many teams do you know have are at home in the NFC Championship, had a bye, but in the game their spread has them as an underdog. That was all about Cutler and the offense.
Yeah.
Wasn't about the defense. Wasn't about the special teams. So you knew these things going in. So I think, you know, the Cutler thing kind of amplifies it. Yeah, I think for everything that you said is right. I love the way you talked about the Bears, the fans, and the quarterback, and not really, you know, since, you know, even McMahon was the closest thing they had. I would argue that I think Harbaugh would have been a better coach if Dicka didn't treat quarterbacks like they were kickers. he thinks of quarterbacks like they're kickers. If Dicka had a better sense of quarterback, Harbaugh had, he would have been a better quarterback. I mean, anyone in Indianapolis had a great career in Indianapolis. But every time they talk about quarterback, they never mentioned Harbaugh was even in Chicago. Then he went out to Indianapolis and became Captain Comeback. You know,
right.
But it was because Dicka, the way Dicka created quarterbacks, that's part of what stifled you, because Dicka thought a quarterback is a kicker. And that was part of the problem that I always thought about Dicka and his evaluation of quarterbacks. So that, without that being said, you know, Cutler was the closest thing in terms of the skill set. He's already got a number of records right now. And he's only been there, what, 2 years?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what you going? My question to Chicago fans: what you gonna do now?
Exactly.
Who's gonna get that better? You'll get Carson Palmer.
They want Caleb Haney back there, man. A dude they didn't even know they had before that game.
And the kid played well, man. But this is the one thing you understand this from basketball. You know, you have a cat that's performing well with 15 minutes. You know, he gives you 10 points, his 6 rebounds, and 2 block shots in 15 minutes. And everybody thinks if you increase 8 minutes, that production is going to go up.
You're going to get that per minute. You're going to get that same per minute production.
And you don't realize that when they start game planning for him, how good is he going to look? I'm not saying, I mean, this kid was leading Colorado State all-time passes. I ain't saying he's not good, but it's always funny, you know. If he was that good, they would move Cutler.
If he was that good, he'd have been ahead of Collins, bum ass.
Yeah, and he played man ahead of Collins. Who Collins, they said he might be bucking for surgery.
Man, Collins was as good as I was on Sunday. All right? We completed the same amount of passes.
You know I'm from Michigan. My student was like, that's a Ty Collins. I can say how he said it. He wasn't that Michigan.
Man, I bet you was shocked he was still alive. I thought he was dead.
That's what Ty Collins was like. Ty Collins was playing. I didn't even know he was still playing. I thought he was
real.
I thought he was a play-by-play analyst in, like, boy.
He's way deep on the NFL Network roster.
You know, that's the kind of cat that comes out. You know, that's Ty Collins here in, you know, Jacksonville against Houston.
You're right.
Texas. Whatever, he just the rep for Jacksonville's NFL Network. I didn't think he was playing. Well, he ain't gonna be playing anymore. That performance, but the Bears are an interesting thing. But it does say a lot about Green Bay. I mean, you know, they play their game. That defense is not nice over there to Packers and. Rodgers had an all right game. He'd have a great game. But they did what they had to do. And the better team won. You know, the better team won. And that's all you can do. My biggest question is, could you continue down the marks? And I know you and I are going to get into that at some point. Talk about with Chicago, and I won't go into that with the Jets. But, you know, when we get into that later, you know, where they go from here, there's going to be some big questions.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with you. The offense was shaky. I think, and we can go ahead and get into it. We can start to talk about it. I think the next step for the Bears is they need to shore up their offensive line, whether that's through free agency or through the draft, but they need to add some talent to that offensive line. And then the next thing they need to do, they need to get a receiver over 6 foot. You know, like the one of the balls that got picked off by Scotty Shields. And again, this is a game. This is one of those moments. This is one of those games in basketball. It's like when the Knicks used to play the Bulls with Jordan and Ewing. Starks made a living off playing good in just those games. You know what I'm saying? He became a hero in New York just off playing playing well in those games. Scotty Shields is loved in Green Bay now. You know what I'm saying? Shields is a star in Green Bay now because he played well in a big game. You know, again, whether it's warranted or unwarranted, you know, he's got to get a free pass for a while. But on one of the Shields picks, is Cutler, and I think it was against Cutler, Cutler underthrew Johnny Knox. Johnny Knox is about 5'10". You don't underthrow a small receiver. You underthrow Larry Fitzgerald. You underthrow Plaxico Burress. You underthrow, you know, somebody who's 6'5", because then they can go on, they can stop, high point the ball over a little DB. You don't underthrow a small guy. You overthrow a speed guy, let him run and get it. And that's why Shields picked it off. They need a receiver with some size. A bigger receiver helps you make up for that loss, make up for the fact that was a bad throw, because they can make a better play on the ball. And I think that's another thing that they need to do. They need to shore up and add some targets on the perimeter for Cutler so they can have a pass, because they don't. You're right. They don't have any other playmakers other than Forte right now. Hester is good, but teams, I think, have figured out how to corral him. And when he's in an offensive set, you know, when they're in their offensive system. And honestly, they don't have the offensive line to truly run Marks' offense the way he likes to have those deep drops where, you know, guys are protecting, and he likes to run those deeper routes, which is good for Cutler because he throws a good deep ball, but they just don't have the personnel on offense right now. And, you know, what'd you say?
What are you going to do with Olsen? I mean, Olsen is a Pro Bowl type tight end who was just lost in his offense.
But, you know, I think Mark has to figure out a way to utilize him better. I think, you know, and I think that would help if they had another big receiver where it would cause teams to have – it would make matchups a little bit harder. Right now, teams can put a safety on them. You know, they can figure out ways to cover Olsen. And I also think they take Olsen they call Olsen out of the game plan sometimes through the play calling. They call him out of the game plan sometimes. And that's not helping their cause either.
When you want to reverse to Bennett, you've been better off throwing a seam route to Olsen.
Right, or a fade to Olsen.
A fade. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about. With a young quarterback like that, why don't you just throw it a fade, throw it to the pylon, to the back pylon, and to where he can get it. That's an easier throw for a guy like that who's coming in the game, who seems to be getting his rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's things like that that just doesn't make sense. You know, but Olsen's that kind of guy that I think he could be. He's a tough cover. The other thing is, this is what I love. When we get to the Steelers or we get to certain teams, this is back to what you and I talk about winning is about having a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
On defense, I know who the Bears are. Chicago on defense. They always what Chicago used to be, always what Chicago will be. They got their middle linebacker. The lineage is passed on. It's like the heavyweight lineage. You know, who's a true heavyweight champion? It's like that
mm-hmm.
who got the belt. You know,
yeah.
passing it from Buckus to Singletary to Urlach. You know, that is there. It's true. On offense, who are they? And
right.
This is, so what you're describing and which I understand is that true teams like this build an offense for who they are and who the elements are. You're playing in Chicago in the NFC Championship game, and you know it's going to be cold as hell. But like you said, while these other people are using small receivers, we got big receivers because it's going to be cold, and all we want you to do is be able to shield your body and
mm-hmm.
catch the ball like Michael Irvin. And if you got to fall to the ground and we get 10 yards of movement, that's what we're going to do. Because that's what you can do in December and January in Chicago on Lake Michigan. That part I don't understand, and that's where Lovey's got to be able to – it looks like he opposed his will a little bit on Mike Marks and said we need to run the football. Because they
did
run the football more. And I can see that he you know, let Mike Miller, we need to be more running. But I agree with you. Would you go after someone like Plaxico Burress?
I don't think it would hurt them. If they can get a good year or two out of Plaxico Burress or try and get Vincent Jackson, you know, or even try and get a squeeze a year out, another year out of T.O.
Yeah.
I don't know if I really would want to put T.O. and Cutler in the same locker room.
It would be too much. That's why I said Plaxico, because he's almost coming back like Mike Vick.
Yeah.
He's looking to just really make a positive image, to get to a place where he gets things done. You know, he's the kind of guy that, and this is where he's a real true security blanket. He was that in Pittsburgh. He was in New York, where you could just put it up there in that space, and he go get it. And for a guy like Cutler, there's sometimes he don't have to be that accurate with a guy like that.
Right.
But if you mix him in with about like a Johnny Knox and some of these other guys, you know, now they're getting the second and third best defender.
Right.
The backfield, and they can win that matchup.
Yes.
But those are things, like you said, the offensive line, they got to really do some work. You know, they got a guy in the middle. They got to really do some work on that line to secure it. They got to build some depth in it. And then I think they got to continue to get some guys in that defensive line. You know, they got some good production, but they got to still build that depth on that defensive line and in the corners. The other thing is that they don't press well. They don't cover well. I think that was the difference against Green Bay. The Green Bay had guys. There's certain times you want that cover two. There's certain times where you got to get up there and press people. And, you know, I think they need to still build some depth in their defensive backfield, have some people who can continue to put pressure in competition in that defensive backfield, you know, that, you know, you can't just be settled in that you're going to be the starter. You're going to bring some young guys in here who got talent who are going to be pushing you. And you mess up, because we got to be a little bit tighter on some things until this offense get going. But I agree with you, that offensive line, and getting a big receiver, and then they got to learn how to feature Forte more.
Yes.
You know, he's a versatile back, and this is a guy who should be near the top in rushing. He should be that kind of guy who's going to, you know, catch you know over 1,000 yards. I mean, he can be that Marshall Faulk type guy. You know, he's got to be more of a feature in the offense.
Yes. Yeah, I agree totally. I agree totally with that assessment. I mean, it really they really just got to figure out who they're going to be and what they're going to be about. And you know, going along those lines of finding an identity that fits with who you are, I want to talk about Atlanta for a moment, man. That team, and I said it last week, whoever Atlanta went up against, even though they had home field advantage, Atlanta was going to be at a disadvantage because of their freaking home field. Like, when you play in a dome and you don't have a team that's built around speed, and you have teams that do have speed coming into your dome, you're putting yourself in a real compromising situation. And I think that's the next thing Atlanta has to do, is Atlanta has to get much quicker on defense. They have to get much faster on defense. Because if you're going to win 14 games, you need to have a defense that can guard people in your building.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a defense that could guard any, that could stop the Packers offense. And if the Falcons had a came, I mean, if the Eagles had a came in there, they would have had the same problem with the speed that the Eagles have on offense, guarding those guys. So, you know, the Falcons, thinking about the Falcons, they got to get faster on defense. You know, I think they got to get faster and they got to add depth. They were lucky this year; they didn't have a lot of injuries. But I think they got to keep adding pieces. I think that's really what you see in the Packers. That is really evident, is that the Packers withstood a ton of injuries, and they just, the next man up was ready. You know, they had a deep, talented roster of guys who fit their system and who can do what they're asked to do, and that's why they're playing in the Super Bowl despite probably losing two of their top five playmakers in Ryan Grant and Jermichael Finley on offense, and for different periods of time, not having some of their best defensive playmakers, you know, not having Cullen Jenkins for a couple of games, not having Clay Matthews for a couple of games, not having Atari Bigby basically all season. I mean, Scotty Shields is an undrafted free agent, rookie, and his play is what prompted them to release Al Harris, you know? And so having a deep roster, I think that's the next step for the Falcons, is developing depth on their roster so that they can withstand injury, and they also have guys being pushed every day in practice, and they're doing a good job of developing talent. I think that's the next step for Atlanta, and I think that's the same place Chicago is also. Chicago's got to get, you know, more in tune with who they are. I totally agree with you. I think Lovey put his foot down a little bit with March and said, look, we need to run the ball, one, because our offensive line just can't – we get sacked 9 times in the freaking half. We need to start running the ball. We need to do something different. And smoke and mirrors, absolutely, in Chicago. It was definitely smoke and mirrors. They got lucky they faced about – they had 2 or 3 games against third-string quarterbacks. Things kind of went their way this year a lot of times where they were facing teams hurt with missing key players. They just caught a lot of teams at the right time, and they did what they needed to do, which was win the games. You know, you can only play who shows up, and they beat whoever showed up, which is props to them. But at the same time, they still left a lot of questions, and I think that's how I felt about Atlanta. There were just a lot of questions about that team as to what their identity is. I still don't feel like I know who Atlanta is as a philosophy on offense and on defense. I don't have a good feel for what they bring to the table as far as what they're trying to do when they're out on the field. Matt Ryan is starting to develop into a solid quarterback, and they got to keep going with that. Roddy White's probably the best, if not one of the top 3 receivers in the league. And Michael Turner shows up, and then sometimes he don't show up for that offense.
And I think in Atlanta, I think I know who they are. They're a power offense. They want to establish a run, and they can stretch the field with Roddy White and Jenkins, and they got the, you know, they got a pretty balance. They want to be balanced, but they really want to be physical with you on offense. On defense, they want to be attacking. They want to get after you and punish you with Abraham. I think the guys, their biggest issue is it's easy to play when you're an underdog. It's hard to play in the league when you're in a front runner. See, they were winning. They were the front runners. They were the target. They weren't the pursuer. Before, they were kind of the underdogs. I think this is where what I saw in that Green Bay game, the Green Bay for a lot of it is battle-tested. Rodgers, they went down to Arizona, went after it, went gunslinging, went out there battling. They were, like you said, in playoff mode for 5 weeks. But Atlanta didn't understand that the intensity was going to change when the lights came on. And the key players, the leaders, I don't think were really ready for the intensity that Green Bay was going to play because they weren't used to playing. I think that was part of the issue. Somebody was talking about that with the Jets, and it really affected when they got in to Pittsburgh because they, for the first time, they were kind of favorites or kind of front runners or people were giving them some things. It wasn't like they were the underdog. You know, how do you behave when the world ain't really against you? And I think that's what Atlanta's problem was mm-hmm. that they were finally viewed as a legitimate team to get to the Super Bowl. They had performed that way during the season, but now you have to come to the playoffs and make it happen.
Yeah.
And I don't know if their biggest players were ready for that moment because they couldn't adjust to the early onslaught and settle people down. The key players, the leaders, those young leaders, had the experience on doing that. You know, even somebody like, Tony Gonzalez. I don't think he's been in the playoffs, but you know, they have huge success in the playoffs, right? So even some of their veteran leaders, they had a couple of people. Abraham, I mean, they got some people probably there, but. The key people like Ryan and Roddy White and some of the cats who are actually performing, you know how it is in sports.
Yep.
Those are the cats who have to know how to raise everybody. And I think they got shocked. They got off their foot and everybody else followed him. As they followed Ryan to victory, they also followed him to defeat. And I think as they learn to deal with that, they're going to be better. I think Coach Smith is the right guy for the job down in Atlanta. So he's got the right pieces. But now it's just about learning how to play when you expect it to win, which is different than when you went under the radar. You know, you passed everybody feeling sorry for what happened with Michael Vick and all, and with Petrino leaving and all that stuff, where everybody was just like, woe is me about Atlanta. And we're just so happy that they got a guy like Ryan and they were coming back and still turning around. Now you passed all that. You can't really bank, you can't cast those chips no more. You know, Mike Vick is back in the league. He's performing in Philadelphia. You've been winning. You're long past that. You're established. Petrino's down at Arkansas doing his thing. That's no longer an issue now. What are you going to do now? And I think this was the first time when it was about that and not about that recent history. And I don't think they could deal with that moment. And to me, that's a psychological thing. But I think if they correct, they got some of those pieces. I mean, given some of the things you talked about, I think they're important. But if they can really rectify and learn to do that, then they'll be successful next year.
Yeah, and I think that'll come with coming into the season favorite. Yeah. You know, I think this year they kind of flew under the radar for a good part of the year. They kind of flew under the radar, but I think next year, at least within their division, they're going to be the hunted, you know. I think in that division this year, everybody came in with their sights set on getting after the Saints.
Yeah.
And I think the Falcons just kind of slowly went along about their business, doing what they needed to do. Then, before you knew it, they had won 14 games. You know, before you really noticed them, they won 10 or 11 games. And now all of a sudden, everybody's trying to resituate how they think about them. Well, next year, if they can still keep winning games, next year will be the test for them, because next year they're going to have to go out, and again, they're going to have to win with a bullseye on their back. And if they can do that, if they can survive that, if they can learn how to do that, that's going to help them. That's definitely going to help them. But I still feel like they have some major glaring personnel issues, given that they're going to invite teams. If they're trying to have a one seed and have a home field playoff game, you're inviting teams to come in, especially in today's NFL, where you have so many teams who are passing base. I mean, if you look at part of the reason the Steelers took it to the Jets, is because the Jets were able to, against the Colts and against the Patriots, because they're so pass-oriented, the Jets were able to just kind of sit back, keep everything in front of them, and force drop play a lot of coverage defenses and force Manning and Brady to see defenses that would usually dictate run to them. You know, they know Manning sees the defense, he's got an audible to run because he sees coverage. So he's going to audible to a run. Well, you ain't got no running game. So go ahead and audible to your run. We gonna gobble that up, and now you're looking at second and nine. And that's what they did to Manning, and that's what they did to Brady also. They dropped back and said, we're going to cover your guys. We're going to straight up cover y'all, and we're going to make y'all beat us with the run. And y'all can't do that. And that's the Jets use that to their advantage. What the Falcons have to be able to do is put a defense on the field that can do that same thing against teams. When you play in a dome, teams are going to – and you have Green Bay coming in who really can't run the ball that well, and you would have had a Philly team coming in who really can't run the ball that well, or a New Orleans team coming in there who really can't run the ball that well. If any three of those teams were playing Atlanta in that divisional playoff game, I would have took those teams over Atlanta. Because Atlanta plays that power football style that's built for Soldier Field. That's built for Lambeau. You know, they have a roster and a team that seems built more for an outdoor team. You know, when you have a team that doesn't fit your own environment and you don't really have an advantage at home, that's what worries me about that team, is I feel like their home field advantage doesn't really exist. So they're actually a team that's probably better off going on the road in the playoffs.
When you say that, because I remember when you first started talking about what Chicago needs, I was like, that's Atlanta. I mean, even the receivers.
Yep.
Talk about the receivers they need. I was like, that's Atlanta's receivers. Right.
Yep.
I mean, if their offense needs to look a lot like Atlanta's offense. If they had their defense and Atlanta's offense, they'd be unstoppable.
Yeah, they would.
That's basically the recent Giants. When the Giants had, their stuff going. I mean, that's the kind of team you needed in Chicago. You're right. I mean, they're not, I love what you said. They're not at an advantage at home. Because teams who come in and play them, like Philadelphia or Green Bay, bring more speed into their house than they have.
Right.
or New Orleans. New Orleans beat them on their turf. Because New Orleans bring, they play on turf, but they bring in, they got a team built for being indoors because they play indoors.
Exactly.
Their team should look more like New Orleans. it's going to be interesting to see how that emerges and what they do. I mean, like you said, the speed they're going to really need is on defense, because their offense is doing all right, but they're going to need that speed on defense, to handle the opposing team's speed. But you're right, maybe they are better off going on the road. Atlanta's an interesting thing in that division, because you know how that division flips every year.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen next year.
Yeah, next year the Panthers are going to win it. We're going to be talking about Carolina and Carson Palmer winning the NFC South.
Carson Palmer. We don't want to segue on him, do we?
We can, man. To me, this all reeks of Pete Carroll. You know me, I'm a conspiracy theory guy, man. This reeks of Pete Carroll. Pete Carroll's got an opening out there in Seattle. Hasselbeck, I think, is on his last leg. And he's like, look, man, if you can leverage Joy out of Cincinnati, we'll make a move. We'll make a deal to get you to Seattle. You come play for me, you throw it to Mike, it'll be like USC all over again. That's what Pete Carroll's going for. Because Pete Carroll knows if he gets a quarterback, he can win that division until Sam Bradford's a beast. Then he's going to have to figure something out. But he can buy himself 2 or 3 years while Bradford is still figuring the league out. He can get 2 or 3 division titles, before Bradford becomes a monster. If he can just get a decent quarterback in there right now.
And while Harbaugh trying to figure out San Francisco, you're right. The thing about it is Carson got to blame himself, because some of that play was because he just played bad, poorly. I mean, how I feel about Cincinnati's organization. I mean, we can deal with culture. But some of their problems was the fact that, for some reason, Palmer didn't play well. His throws were terrible. Footwork, something just gone with his game that wasn't gone before. So the timing of this is terrible, because it's not like you were making great plays and people around you weren't doing anything. You were playing poorly, and people recognized that you were playing poorly. So I don't know, where's your leverage?
And to me, that's why I view this as, like, he wants to get back with Carroll, because Carroll still views him highly. You know what I mean? He wants to go back to that security blanket, where it's like, okay, he still thinks I'm a great quarterback. I want to go play there or else I'm done. These people don't believe in me no more, so I don't want nothing to do with this. I don't want nothing to do with this anymore. These people are down on me. They don't believe in me. They don't see me the way they used to see me. I want out. To me, that's what this feels like, demanding a trade out in the open. Like, this ain't even like Carson Palmer's MO. Carson Palmer's been a pretty, as far as, he's a pretty media savvy, image savvy guy, as far as his image and how he carries himself. He's dealt with Ocho Cinco basically his whole career and never really gotten the crosshairs with him, in the media or publicly, which is pretty easy to do. So the fact that he's been able to avoid that, seems to hint to me that he's fairly savvy about, mincing his words and what he needs to say in the media. He knows how to play that game. So the fact that he's coming out and using the media to leverage himself out of there really, I think, speaks to the fact that I think he's had enough of that situation. I think he feels like he needs a change of scenery to kind of revitalize himself. Maybe he didn't play well, and he didn't. And maybe he knows that he didn't play as well as he did, but I think he also feels like, what I need right now is a change of scenery. What I need is to get away from this environment, get away from this team, get away from this locker room. And maybe for him, maybe he wanted Marvin Lewis gone. And with Marvin Lewis coming back, maybe he says, okay, that's enough. Okay, I've been down this road, this ain't gonna work, this doesn't work for me, I want out. it was either, you know, maybe secretly Palmer was like, it's either me or him. If he goes, maybe I can stay. But if he stays, I can't stay, you know.
And that, you know, because Ocho came out in support of Palmer, but I guess there's a couple of jabs between him and between Ocho and Lewis. And there is a sense, I'm sensing, is that the issue that you just said? You know, maybe we don't know. Maybe we're thinking the relationship is rosy, but maybe it's not. Maybe Palmer is saying that, you know, we tolerated a locker room like this. Because Palmer is a guy that really wanted some order,
mm-hmm.
wanted some more accountability. And that locker room and that place had some issues. I mean, I think when they won a division last year, it looked like they pulled that all together. But it seemed like it kind of went back to some of that this year. That, you know, the control of the locker room, the structure, the accountability is not there. I don't know, maybe he doesn't feel that Lewis is handling that part of it, is the accountability that's allowing some of these things to just go. You know, he looks over at New England and he sees a different kind of locker room. He looks over at Pittsburgh, he sees a different kind of locker room. He looks over at Baltimore, sees a different kind of locker room, you know, that, you know, a lot of that stuff isn't tolerated. It's managed. But some of that is players managing it. You look at all those examples. You know, something like Baltimore, that's John Harbaugh, but that's also Ray Lewis managing the locker room along with other veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing in Pittsburgh. Yeah, that's Tomlin, but that's also some veterans like Hines Ward and those guys who are saying this is what we do. And the same thing, you can't have a locker room like that without having players who also manage the locker room. And so that might be part of the issue with him. But the bottom line, he's got to own up to that he just hasn't played well. And they didn't win the division because he played well. They ran the division because they ran the football and they
right.
didn't throw as much. So part of his issue is going to be, you know, he's not on the right side of his issue right now, because anybody who knows football knows that he hasn't been playing well. Now, is his career done? I'm saying no. I think with some changes, some things happening, I think he's got a young, great tight end. I think he's got some pieces there to play well, to really build some confidence. But, you know, he's got to own up to the fact that their success has not only been a culture thing, but has been the fact that he hasn't led and hasn't played well. And I don't know how you get around that. That's, you know, when Ocho and all these other cats tried to get out back then, back in the day, they was playing well. When Chad was asking for a trade, or when Dylan was asking for a trade, these cats were playing at a high level, and they had leverage. You know, this cat asked for a trade, he ain't even playing at a high level, just using Cincinnati as an example and being consistent. Dylan was asking for a trade when he was playing for losing teams and still near the top in rushing.
Right.
Carrying three or four people. Everybody, even Cincinnati fans, are like, maybe we got to let you go. We don't want to let you go. We got to let you go somewhere. You get to. They felt so sad for it. They're like, we got to let you go.
Absolutely.
You know, so it'd be interesting to see what happens with Carson.
It will. It really will. You know, like I said, I hope he gets to go to a situation where he has an opportunity to revitalize his career, because he's falling the hell off.
Yeah.
I mean, dude went from being right in that next tier after the Brady and Mannings, and now, like, I mean, nobody's even talking about this young man no more. You know, I mean, he's not even in a conversation. So, you know, I hope it all gets sorted out. But I also thought it was interesting that Ocho was kind of like, we're going to see how this all – Ocho was kind of like, we're going to see how all this plays out, because I asked for a trade. I didn't get traded.
Right.
Somebody else asked for a trade. We're going to see how the media – and what he's saying, what Ocho is saying is, I want to see how the media treats Carson. You know,
right.
They crucified me for asking for a trade, for asking out. I want to see how the media and the organization is going to treat Carson right now, you know?
That's right.
That's
we all know that's going to be interesting. And I'm glad the way he put it. You know, he put it out there in the right way.
Yep.
So,
yeah, so this is going to play out. You know, the theater is beginning. The off-season theater is beginning. They just got to solve this whole labor issue, man. They're going to mess up a good thing. I'm telling you, between the NBA and the NFL, man, they got to get these labor issues figured out. They got to get them figured out fast, man, because the NBA is having a great year this year, too. And if they lose this momentum, it's gonna hurt both leagues.
They
ain't gonna kill them. It ain't gonna kill them. We're just gonna hurt them a bit, you know.
They said what they had over 100 million people watch those games.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of eyeballs, you know, on these games. The product is at an all-time high. They're gonna have to. And it's, you know, it's really going to come down to the 18-game season and some of those things and the health benefits and all that long-term stuff, you know, that they're going to have to figure out about how they're going to, settle some of these things. And, you know, part of some of the things coming up is, you know, possibly rather than adding 18 games, you add more teams to the playoffs and maybe have, you know, additional rounds of the playoffs. And that might equate to what an 8-game season might be. So you're still sticking to the 16 games with, you know, more teams in the playoffs, you know, fewer byes. I mean, there's some different things to kind of, you know, look at some of that stuff in terms of creating that structure and still coming out with maybe the same number of games being played or whatever. They have to come up with something, you know, it's going to be making it worth people's while to put their bodies out there the way they've been putting them out there. But, you know, they can't be messing with that golden goose. That egg is just something that they're going to have to protect because, you know, people in this economy don't want to hear either side. And the players are always going to lose this just because of people's perception of athletes. You know, might always lose this argument. So it's going to be a battle that, you know, hopefully doesn't go into a lockout. And if it does, that's just something that would be bad for an ending to what has been a pretty good season with a lot of stories. You know, that I know you and I will reflect on, you know, probably post Super Bowl the storylines for the season. But I think those are the issues.
Yeah. I hope they figure it out because, you know, it's been an exciting season, you know, a lot of great moments, you know. I'm sure at this point you've seen the Bart Scott interview. To me, that was the interview of the season right there.
Well, that might have been the interview of the decade. I mean,
man, that was an excellent interview. I mean, that's right up there with Denny Green post-game. A couple years back, man, that was, I mean, just to look on Sal Palantonio's face, it's like he went from, oh, this is a great interview, to wait a minute, man, did I say anything bad about the Jets? Let me think. And then it went to, let me just wrap this up. And, you know, I see you in Pittsburgh. Can't wait. Oh, man, that was the stuff right there. That's one of the main reasons I watch sports. That's one of the main reasons I watch sports. You know, unfortunately for the Jets, they didn't have that same, you know, and that's the tough thing about being a team like that, you know, where you're like before the playoffs started and we were picking, I said, you know, the Jets are a team that hits peaks and valleys. And so at the end of the season, I felt like they were coming out of a valley and they were peaking. And that's why I said I felt like they were a dangerous team. They were peaking. They were going in the right direction. But at the same time, they peaked at that Patriots game. And when they peak, they valley. You know what I'm saying? And they valleyed against the Steelers, man. I mean, they didn't have it. The Steelers are a tough team, man. And what has to happen for people to start to really recognize and appreciate Troy Polamalu is probably, if not the greatest, one of the top two or three safeties ever at his position.
Yeah.
He makes such a huge difference for that defense.
Yeah. I look at, there are a couple of players on the Steelers that I think, when they're done playing, you're going to say, wow. I mean, because this has been a year of so many great players. you know, involved in their game. You know, that it's been good to, you know, watch football here, particularly over the last 10 years, watching the Ray Lewis's of the world and all these great players. But Polamalu has just been playing at such a high level, and you can tell when he's not there, the impact on the team. I mean, his importance in terms of facing Green Bay is going to be is evident. I mean, he's going to have a huge game again. But this cat will start in the deep third, and before he'll end up in the backfield.
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw him pre-snap, like, in the deep third. How the hell did he end up in the backfield? I mean, he can cover so much field a play. I mean, he runs a 4.4. I mean, he runs, 4.3. I mean, he runs he's pretty fast. I don't think people realize that he's that fast. But he's like a missile. Every time he looks like he's throwing his body around, like it's just a disregard for his body. I mean, this guy is incredible, and you know, wow. And given when you see so many safeties who play like that getting hurt, you know what I'm saying? You know, Ed Reed has been in and out of injuries lately, and he's one of Ed Reed's another great guy, great, great safety. I mean, incredible player, but yeah, Ed's been banged up and in and out, and the same with Polamalu. But Polamalu is, for the most part, other than these recent years, he's just now breaking down, but for a long time, he wasn't getting hurt at all. And so he's so versatile player. Covering, he's playing up on the line. He's required to do so much in that blitz scheme package, and it's all built around him being in the right place. The thing I'm wondering, and I told you this, is Tomlin. Given your starting quarterback missed the first five games or four games, came back the fifth game. And, you know, we talked about this from the beginning of the season. At some point, I know they're talking about it, but at some point, people have to recognize how good this guy is as a coach. I mean, at an elite level. Not just the players know it. But I just don't – sometimes I don't feel like – I mean, we give Andy Reid, and I love Andy Reid, so much accolades and all this stuff. But if Andy Reid had accomplished what Tomlin just accomplished, people would be talking about Andy Reid like he's a Hall of Fame coach.
It's true.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, Andy Reid gets so much love, and Andy Reid ain't won no Super Bowl.
It's just true.
And Tomlin is played the first set of games without his starting quarterback, was predicted not to win the division, got into another Super Bowl. If he wins this Super Bowl, when is the conversation going to shift about how this guy coaches?
Yeah.
That's the part that I'm really going to be interested to see what happens. Do people talk about him like Belichick?
Yeah, man, I think you have to. I think you have to. I mean, this dude is, you know, you may want to say he's like the total package. I mean, he's great with motivating players. He's sound with his X's and O's. The Steelers never seem unprepared for an opponent. I've never watched a Steeler game where I felt like he got outcoached. I have yet to watch a game where I felt like he got outcoached or he mismanaged the play clock or he mismanaged the game clock. You know, I just feel like he's always on top of it, and he runs a tight ship. He gets players to buy in, and that whole franchise, that whole culture is just really I think it's just a testament to everybody involved with that situation that they're doing what they're doing, and they're consistent, you know. I mean, they're getting contributions from guys. I mean, it's the same thing when I talk about the Packers organization where it's the next man up. The Steelers have such a deep roster. When you got Antonio Brown and Emmanuel Sanders making plays on offense, you know, those are your third and fourth string wide receivers, and they're rookies.
That's right.
You know, they're rookies, but they fit. They fit. They're guys who weren't on a lot of people's radars. The guys that they found that fit their system, that fit their culture, and they bring them in and they develop them. Mike Wallace is the same way. Mike Wallace wasn't a big name. He's a big-time player, though.
Yeah.
And you know, it's – and
it's a testament to the coach. It's a testament to the GM. It's a testament to everybody involved. But I think, you know, the league is going to have to start, again, if Tomlin wins another championship, they are definitely going to have to start looking at him differently. The same way they're going to have to start talking about Big Ben differently.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to take this whole franchise and put it in a different, it's going to put it in that Patriot echelon where you talk about, you know, the last decade and all of the winning and success the Patriots had and how people had to think about Brady and Belichick. You know, because before this last 10 years, Belichick was an afterthought as a coach.
Yeah.
You know, Belichick was not well thought of as far as being a successful coach. You know, he got the right guys into his system. He got a system where he had control. And I think what has happened is Tomlin has found that system earlier in his career than Belichick did. Tomlin has been put in a situation where he's in the ideal situation for him to be successful, and he's doing his thing. And at some point, people are going to start to have to look at that. And then what's going to also be interesting is once you start to see his coaches getting snatched up. I think that's also a sign of respect amongst, you know, executives. And when you start to get that league-wide respect is when you start to see people picking guys off your coaching tree. The same way with Dungy. You know, he got Lovie Smith a gig. You know, Tomlin was working for him. Raheem Morris was on that coaching staff. So, you know, you got all these guys who are now getting gigs off of that Dungy tree and they're having success. And so, you know, I think that's going to be also another piece of building Tomlin's legacy. But I mean, like I said, if I was in the league and I had an opportunity to pick a team to play for, man, I'd play for Pittsburgh just because, you know, Tomlin make me want to run through my TV sometimes. He make me want to tackle my 46-inch. You know,
I mean, he neutralized the entire Rex bravado last week. It was a love fest. And the thing about it was he was honest about it. I like Rex. You know, because he talks to Rex. I mean, from the way he handles the media, it's like we ain't have no drama. The way he handles how they play, he's like, that's just a standard way. We like it. We like to struggle. You know what I'm saying? You know, most people might say you play the inconsistency. Like, you know, that's just how we win. We win ugly, but we win. I mean, just the whole idea of how he's handling that.
Yep.
I mean, this is going to be, you know, McCarthy and all this stuff. I mean, this is going to be two coaches from two historic kind of teams in history coming together. I mean, this is the right Super Bowl at the right time for this league. But I'm really happy. I called the Steelers at the beginning of the playoffs because, you know, if people know I'm a Steelers fan. But I felt like they had the right pieces in place. Before this year, I didn't feel like they had, you know, they had it. And a lot of it had to do with the running game. I felt like their running game was a lot more aggressive this year than it had been in previous years. I felt like they finally was as close as they were when they had the bus.
Uh-huh.
You give them a good running game that you got to really check, then that makes Roethlisberger even that much dangerous. And it allows the defense to be who they want to be when that running game is right. And you saw that on display last week. So that part I really felt good about them. And I felt like, and I called this about New England, the offense was great. The part that people didn't understand about New England is that their defense was smoke and mirrors. I was talking to you about Chicago's offense being smoke and mirrors. New England's defense was smoke and mirrors. When people were buying into that New England Kool-Aid, what I felt good about the New England offense was what they were doing, because that's the day they won championships, was they had an offense that was hard to game plan against. You didn't know where they were going to go. That part held true. But when they won the championships, they also had this defense that was sound. It didn't get a lot of pub, but Teddy Bruschi and those cats could play. They were sound. I felt like this defense had a lot of holes. And it was smoke and mirrors. They had some turnovers every once in a while, but they weren't as sound as people put it. And that's what played out in the Jets game, was that this defense was exposed because they weren't in any top categories in anything. And they didn't put a lot of pressure. They got a lot of sacks, which was good for Sanchez. Sanchez struggles against teams that puts a lot of pressure on him. And so but the New England defense wasn't shored up. And so these are some of the things as I was looking at the playoffs and trying to evaluate the Steelers and some of these other teams was about this, who got that smoke and mirrors?
Mm-hmm.
Like, whose stuff is really legit? I knew.
Yeah.
And what was different about it? And I think you identified some things when you talk about Green Bay and what kind of memory they had. When you look at all their phases, there were no real smoke and mirrors. It was solid. They got a
mm-hmm.
philosophy. The next person stepped up, and that person's really playing. There wasn't a lot of smoke and mirrors that they were playing. There's some solid football when you look at those teams. And some of these other teams had some of those smoke and mirrors. Same thing with the New York Jets. You know, their smoke and mirror, at the end of the day, they're Sanchez. That's just what it is. I said people are evaluating them this year, and all the stuff they're talking about this year is what I think they're going to be next year.
Mm-hmm.
But Sanchez is really supposed to be a rookie this year.
Yeah.
You know, next year, as a third-year quarterback, he'll get to that level. But I think people were, as they say, he can't be the reason that they lose it. When he stops being the reason that they lose it, that's when they're going to win a championship.
I feel you. I feel you on that. Going back to the Patriots, I kind of saw them a little bit differently, though. And I didn't see it up until I was watching that Jet game. But there was one play, and I think it was a fourth down. It was a fourth down play, and Brady threw a pass to Deion Branch. And Branch dropped it. And it was, for me, just an instinctive reaction, but I just yelled out. Moss would have caught that. You know what I mean? And I think what hurt them in that game, they didn't have enough real playmakers. They had too vanilla of a team. They had too many guys who were just cogs on offense. And they didn't have any real playmakers. And that's why they had opportunities to take that game from the Jets. They had opportunities to move the ball, and their playmakers, the guys who, other than Brady, who was supposed to help complete plays, there was nobody to go to. And when the Jets figured out how to neutralize Brady, they figured out how to neutralize the rest of that team. Because the Jets got Revis. They can always take away your best receiver. So what is everybody else around you going to do? I mean, they did the same thing to the Colts. Took Wayne out. The rest of them cats couldn't make plays. The rest of the receivers out there wasn't getting open, wasn't making plays. And so I think just as much as they were, I think Brady fooled us into thinking that offense was more than it really was. Because, again, when it came down to crunch time, they have a bunch of role players on offense. You and I know role players can make plays down the stretch, but they still ain't playmakers. They're role players. And at the end of the day, I think they had a lot of role players on that offense.
They had role players. They had no Troy Brown. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because back then,
they didn't have a big shot, Rob. They didn't have a Derek Fisher, a guy who's going to make that catch.
That's right.
And they didn't have a Kobe. They didn't have a LeBron. They didn't have a closer, a big play closer guy either. And so that's what hurt that team, in my opinion.
But back in the day, the closer was Brady making that right pass to the right person. And what happened under Moss, even though they had that great season, but once you started figuring out, you knew that they were one-dimensional. It was like, there were times when they looked like the Raiders under it looked like it was like Al Davis was up there calling plays.
We'll get into Al too.
Because what they need, yeah, they need that deep play threat like Moss, but they need a guy who can run multiple routes deep. So you need a cat that doesn't just run deep, but a guy who can run deep. But I mean, they almost would be better. T.O. in his early days, T.O., that's why, you know, I always battled with Moss and T.O. What I like about T.O. is that T.O. runs multiple routes. Back in the day, he could beat you deep. He beat you across the middle. He beat you. T.O. runs, that's why I think sometimes T.O. get a bad thing. T.O. runs all the routes.
He runs all the routes well.
That's the kind of guy they need in New England. So if you're going to have that kind of cat, now, not T.O. now. You know, it might be Ocho Cinco. You need a cat that who can run multiple routes, who ain't afraid to run across the middle, but who can still run deep. I mean, that's the kind of guy who got to play with Brady in that offense. You just can't be, I mean, you can't be Moss running because it worked in that one season, but I think after people make an adjustment and they know Moss is only going to run two routes, and yeah, he stretches the defense, but if you feel the need, you always got to get him the ball, then it disrupts what I think Brady is best, and what Brady is best is just finding the open guy.
And I'm not necessarily saying that the playmaker had to be Moss. All I'm saying is there was a lack of a legit playmaker other than Brady in that game down the stretch. What I think the Jets did a good job of is making it so that Brady had to go through multiple reads. Like there were times where Brady had all the time in the world, and they were like, "Okay, beat us. We want you to beat us because we know these guys can't get open. Yeah, you can make the right throw. Yeah, you're going to make the right throw, but ain't nobody going to be open because we got eight guys in coverage. And these receivers aren't good enough to beat eight guys."
But the thing about it is, even given that, Brady still had enough offense to win. The difference was that the Jets' offense beat the Jets' offense beat New England's defense, which was smoke and mirrors. Because if New England's defense was really stronger, because the Jets' offense is much improved, but it's not very – to me, they run multiple stuff, but it's not very, very sophisticated. Now, they don't run the football at you. You know, they're going to try and get throws for Sanchez that's back shoulder throws. He's going to do some multiple reads, but they're going to try and really make it so – you can cut the field in half sometimes for him and make some easy throws early. You know, third down, he's going to go to Dustin Keller for a lot of times. He's going to go because that's where he's going to be able to get reception, or he's going to San Antonio Holmes. I mean, he's going to go to one of those two places, but especially if it's third and five, he's looking for Dustin. And that's a battle you got to win. I think, you know, Pittsburgh figured out we can win that.
The reason I blame the offense is if you contrast the 45-3 game to the playoff game, the big difference is the offense wasn't nearly as effective as it was in that first game. The offense wasn't nearly as effective as it was that first game. So what that told me was that the Jets went back and they saw that they could limit what they did on offense. When you go from putting up 45 on somebody to struggling to put up points, that to me that says that's offense more than defense. To me that says that they figured out something. They saw something in your offense on film that they knew that they could limit you guys. They could slow you guys down. They knew that they could do something to your offense. They saw it on film. This is what we can do to their offense that will limit their effectiveness.
That part I understand, but I'm saying that. You knew that was going to happen. You knew they were going to score 43, 45 points. You knew Rex was going to allow that. But what killed me is that there's nothing in the Jets. What changed about the Jets' offense that allowed them to feel like they could move the ball on New England's defense? Because the Jets had to make some big plays and had to make some big drives.
They wasn't down 30 points? Because I think the Jets are a different team when they're playing from behind. Just like the Bears are a different team if they're playing from behind. When the Packers went up 14-0 on the Bears, I said if the Packers get one more touchdown, whether it's in the first quarter, second quarter, the game is over. I don't care how much time is left because the Bears aren't that type of team where they can come back. And the Jets aren't that type of team where they're going to come from behind. They aren't built that way. And so I think what happened was when you get a blowout-esque score, that puts the Jets in a situation where now they got to depend on Sanchez's arm, and Sanchez ain't there yet. But I think in this game, the defense was able to keep New England's offense in check, which allowed the Jets' offense to do what they needed to do against the Patriots' defense.
But what I
don't think the Patriots' defense was that good holding the Jets to 3 points. I don't think the Patriots' defense is a defense that's ever going to hold a team to 3 points. You know, but I think what happened was we got fooled into thinking the offense was an offense that was a 45, a real – because they put up a lot of points against people. That offense put up a lot of points all season. Then they get to the playoffs, and now all of a sudden, that's where I see the smoke and mirrors, is that all season the defense was decent. As Bart Scott said, 25th in the league, the numbers say it, the defense wasn't that great. It wasn't like the defense was ranked – like the Bears' defense, which was highly ranked, you know, that's not a smoke and mirrors defense. The Patriots defense, I think, was helped by their offense getting up on people really quick and allowing them to be in a position where they're playing downhill a lot of the game and they're able to get after people a lot of the game and they have quarterbacks and teams gambling against them. The offense is what didn't underperform to me in the playoff game. I thought the defense played how they've been playing all season, but the offense didn't give them a huge lead where they could be super aggressive and play downhill.
Look, I'm looking at this and I'm saying the Jets were up 14-3 at the half. So they scored 14 points. The Jets scored 14 points in the second quarter, 14 points in the fourth quarter. And what I'm saying is I agree, but I think what happened was when you look at the streak, the game I watched, I think it might have been the Green Bay game when they played at New England. I think it was Green Bay. That played at New England. They gave them that run for their money.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Green Bay didn't really have a running game.
Right.
When you saw Green Bay running on New England with Wolford in there, I said, this is the blueprint. Folks have figured out. Because that's the way you beat Brady. What they figured out is, yeah, the Jets play effective defense, but what they understood is you cut Brady's possession down and you make every possession for him count because that's where he was pressing. First of all, he threw the interception right off the bat, which rattle was messed up. I think that set the stage. But then when he had to sit and they had those long time of possessions and then he had to come back on and try to figure out how to get jump started on it, because the reason why they couldn't get those three and outs, when people figured out you could really run on this Patriot defense and you could really push it and use that to cut, because the best way to beat them is keep them on the sidelines. And when you got them in, with your game plan, you force him to press.
And make him have to have a 15-14 play drive. Why? Because they don't have no big play capability because they ain't got no playmakers. They can't. They're not a quick strike. They're not a quick strike offense, so you keep them off the field. And then when they get on the field, you make them have to beat you down the field. You keep everybody in front of you. You make them have to beat you down the field, and you limit his windows.
But part of your defense, your 12th player on your defense is your offense. That's what creates that effect for Brady. To me, that's the biggest thing, is that if you look at time of possession for them, that was the biggest thing that enhanced what you just said. Because Brady could be patient. You know, the biggest thing I thought they did was they weren't patient enough, New England. They could have been a little bit more patient about it. Brady could have been a little bit more patient. I think they pressed a little bit too much. But it was when they realized their defense couldn't stop them at all. They couldn't stop the run. They couldn't stop. When you score 14 points in the second quarter, and then they scored another 14 here in the fourth, that's telling you right now, we ain't stopping you.
But at the same time, the same offense that put up 45 wasn't getting no points. They wasn't. I mean, 14 points and a half is not bad. If you're supposed to be what you're supposed to be on offense, this juggernaut on offense that the Patriots were supposed to be, this offensive juggernaut, this offensive machine, you're supposed to put up more than 3 points. I don't care who you're going against.
I'm looking at time of possession. Let me look at time of possession right now.
And I hear that, but at the same time, when the Colts are clicking and when Peyton Manning is on and he's got weapons, it don't matter if you keep Peyton Manning on the field. He'll score in 30 seconds. He will score in 30 seconds. Why? Because he's got playmakers. New England don't got playmakers. When the Colts had Harrison and Reggie Wayne, and Stokely, man, that was the game plan for Peyton Manning. Keep him off the field, long drives, run on the defense. They did the same thing. This New England team was like those old Colts teams, except they didn't have playmakers on the outside. They didn't have playmakers on the perimeter. Those Colts teams, the defense was always, that was the game plan against all the Colts defenses, you know, the last 10 years is run on them. Keep Manning off the field. Manning would still get on the field and score. Whether it was a 2-minute drive or a 3-minute drive, he was scoring because he had playmakers. And I think that's where the smoke and mirrors was with this Patriots team, was on offense.
Yeah, I feel like But I felt like the offense was good enough to win. I felt like the defense wasn't a championship defense.
No, it wasn't a championship defense, but I also felt like it wasn't a championship defense all season. What made it a good defense was the offense was able to get points on people and was able to get up early on people, which made the, which allowed the defense to play downhill. Once the smoke and mirror offense, once somebody figured out how to stop that offense, then, yeah, the defense was exposed for what it really was. But I think what we were looking at was an offense that really wasn't what we thought it was, as far as the offense being able to go up against anybody and put points on the board.
So I'm looking at this right now. So the Jets are in red zone, what, 4 out of 5? What do we got? 4 to 5 times? Not 5 times and scored 4? And so, I mean, when I'm looking at this, and I can't talk time possession. I will give you that. New England has actually 34 minutes and 56 in time of possession. Honestly, I was just trying to look at the game stats in comparison.
Yeah.
Because when I was looking at, when they were going to that run, the one thing I saw right away when I looked at it, when they went to run, and everybody's talking about their unstoppable, and I saw that Green Bay game, I said, Green Bay got the blueprint. If everybody watched what Green Bay just did, that's the blueprint. If you got a good enough defense, because I looked at, and that was right after they blew them up 45-3. I said, the Jets are going to watch this because the same 3-4 defense, you're going to have to play some coverage. But the biggest thing is you got to cut down. You got to be able to run that football on this defense. And if you can run that football on this defense and keep these drives and make it real kind of haphazard, I mean, I think that's where I think what you're saying about having the playmaking receivers come in. But if you can control that ball and don't let them be optimistic and really cut down on Brady's possessions and opportunities, you're going to play against – you're going to beat him. Because he's going to figure out how to – if you give him too many opportunities, he's going to figure out how to win. But you got to figure out how to control that line of scrimmage. And people weren't really doing that. And I don't know how often they were up by a lot. Because they were scoring a point. I mean, other than the Chicago game was a blowout, the Green Bay game wasn't a blowout, and the Jets game was a blowout. I don't know how many other the Pittsburgh game. I don't know if that was a blowout. That was a comfortable win. I don't know if that was a blowout.
I mean, this Patriots team had the San Diego game. They won 23-20. The Baltimore game. They won 23-20. Those are the only two games where they scored less than 28 points. Those are the only two games where this team scored less than 28 points all season.
Mm-hmm.
And down the stretch, down towards the last 9 games of the season, they had 31 points or more in every game. And the Jets game was a blow. They blew out the Lions 45-24. They blew out the Jets 45-3. They blew out the Bears 36-7. They blew out Buffalo at the end of the season 34-3. They blew out Miami at the end of the season 38-7. I mean, the numbers show the defense wasn't that great. Like Bart said, 25th in the league. Couldn't stop a nosebleed. You know, the defense was what it was. I think the defense lived off the offense. I think, you know, the defense's numbers aren't outstanding.
And if you look at it, really, I mean, if you go aside the numbers, like, let's get real with this. If you take from week 12 on, they played Chicago, and Chicago was still shaky at that time. They played Green Bay, but they also played Detroit, like you said, Buffalo, and Miami. So that's going to inflate your stats anyway. Because Miami was basically packing up and had the U-Haul. Buffalo wasn't really a match. Detroit was formidable, but they still learned how to win. And really, the Chicago game was just such a – it's hard to even talk about the Chicago game because of weather and everything. It was just – that was such a weird game. But the Green Bay game in there is probably the game where you had a team that was probably equally matched to take them on.
I mean, the Jets thought they were ready, but they weren't really ready for that moment. But the Green Bay game is probably, if you take from week 12 on, I mean, other than because you had Indianapolis and Pittsburgh in there somewhere where those are kind of battles. But if you take from really week 12 on, I mean, the only team that was really ready mentally to challenge it was Green Bay. If you were, I mean, just even looking at it, I mean, the Jets were, we still had questions about Sanchez. I mean, prior to that, people were talking about benching Sanchez. Right?
Right.
So, I mean.
Here's another stat, all right? They play Pittsburgh, Green Bay, Baltimore, Chicago. Those are the top four scoring defenses in the league. All right? If you look at the points they put up on Chicago's defense, 36. Pittsburgh's defense, 39. Baltimore, they put up 23 in a close game. What they do against Green Bay, they put up 31. Those are the top four scoring defenses in the league. Those are the top four scoring defenses in the league. To me, the offense was what was smoke and mirrors.
But
the Jets had a second time. They came back at them, looked at it, looked at what was going on, and said, okay, this is how we can beat this team. We give Brady all the time in the world, but he's throwing against an eight-man coverage. And these receivers can't beat us. These receivers is not going to – we can give Brady – in the game, Brady was standing back there. He looking left. He looking right. You can see Brady going through his progression. You can see him going through twice, and ain't nobody getting open. Ain't nobody getting open. They basically dared their receivers to be able to beat them.
But I'm saying if the offense and the defense, those are two the top offenses in the Jets are one of the top defenses, right? Right?
Yeah.
So that's like we putting strength against strength. And the second time I see you in a fight, you ain't going to bloody my nose like that. You know that's going to be the top offense, the top defense. You know that's going to be a close gap. So then you got to go to the second. You got to go to the second thing because you know they're going to be a stalemate. They both battling powerhouses. So now you got to go to the Jets offense and the Patriots defense. Who's going to win that battle? Because you know the next
you got you, but you got two mediocre defenses. That I mean, you got a two mediocre unit.
But and somebody got to step up and play. And the people who stepped up and made big plays were the Jets offense. Big play, this back shoulder throw to
and that's exactly my point. And that's exactly my point is that the Jets offense because they got playmakers.
But the
Antonio's a playmaker. LaDainian's a playmaker. The Patriots offense should have stepped. I mean, the Patriots offense is one of the top offenses in the league. It shouldn't matter what defense they go against. They should put points up.
You and I just talked about the playoff format with two top defenses and two offense. You ain't gonna have no 45 points in no playoff game like that. I just knew the Jets defense wasn't going to give up no more 45 points. It wasn't. They just too powerful. And for the reason, when I get a second look at you, when you're a top defense, you ain't going to get me like you got me last time. I know that. That part I don't. So now the people who got to win that battle is my offense or your defense has got – somebody got to win this battle in special teams. Y'all got to win it because we ain't going to have the same kind of thing we just had the last time. Like, this offense ain't going to score 45 points, and we ain't giving up 45
right,
points.
Right, right.
So one of y'all got – so y'all going to have to do something. And
right, but 3 points and a half? Yeah. 3 points and a half? The Pacers, all they could get was 3 points and a half?
Because it's the playoff. You know how – it's back to what we say about the NBA. I know it's a week of preparation in football, but in the regular season, that's a, this is what we just talked about in Atlanta. It's a different thing when you go to the playoffs.
Right, and what I'm saying is I think in this game the difference lied in the Jets' inability to move the ball on offense. That's what was the difference in this game because that allowed the Patriots' inability to move the ball on offense. The Jets didn't score until the second quarter. The Patriots had a whole quarter to get things going and get their offense going. And then they had a whole third quarter where the defense shut them out. But when you allow a team like the Jets to stick with what they do, you're putting yourself in a bad situation.
I understand that.
Because you're not putting no pressure on them offensively. If you don't, just in the same way as in that first game they jumped out on them, that jumping out on them forced Sanchez to have to beat them. Sanchez isn't that good. The Jets offense isn't that good. But if you allow them to do what they do, to stay in rhythm, to run the ball, to be able to establish their run game, yeah, you're going to be in trouble. I don't care who you are.
But deep down, you knew the Patriots were gonna come up and Rex was gonna do it. Rex had to go out there and pull a Woody Hayes on him, trip somebody.
And you know what? I'm not even saying that they needed to put up 45, but they didn't even hit their average.
They were
well below their average. I mean, 21 points by the league's highest scoring team, one of the highest scoring teams in the last 10 years.
What gonna happen? You knew Rex Ryan was so possessed. He was so embarrassed. You knew that what gonna happen. I don't care. He put 8 back there, like you said. He wasn't gonna let it happen.
Exactly, and I'm saying that's because he figured out that this offense is smoke and mirrors, that this offense really has no playmakers. This offense doesn't have a guy who you're like, we need to double this dude. There's no double team. There's no double on that defense. There's no double. You don't have to worry about the running back, really. Yeah, I mean, the running back, nobody other than Brady.
No, what he realized were the playmakers were the tight ends, and that's why he moved Revis to the inside. Sometimes on the tight ends, he thought about the tight ends like they were receivers. The playmakers were actually the tight ends. So what he did was he moved Revis and other folks to the inside, covering some of those tight ends on some key downs, putting them on some of the two young tight ends, putting Revis on them, covering them in different ways. So he understood. He reevaluated who the playmakers were. The playmakers in this new offense were the tight ends, and because you rarely have safeties or linebackers who can run with tight ends like this, he realized he had to move some of his strength to cover those tight ends because he knew his receivers were going to be there. They had playmakers, but the playmakers were in places that you normally don't see playmakers, and that's that tight end.
And what I'm saying is if you don't make plays in the fourth quarter of the game, you ain't really no playmaker.
But the tight ends have been making plays all season in the fourth quarters in games.
Right, but what did they do in the playoffs? That's what I'm saying, and that's what I'm saying. The offense lacked a true give me the ball now, big time type player. Like if Roethlisberger needs a first down, he's looking at Hines Ward first. He may have to go down to Antonio Brown, but he's looking at Hines Ward first, and the defense is looking at Hines Ward first.
But if you think about it, the Patriots won their Super Bowls without one of those guys. They didn't have one of those guys that you're talking about.
And I think the league is caught up to that.
Well, I mean, I'm just telling you how they won Super Bowls and how they wanted to do this. They didn't have guys like that when they won Super Bowls. Not one guy like that. They had like 4 or 5 guys. None of them were really individually great. But somebody stepped up. Brady was the guy. Brady was the guy dealing the cards. That's how they won it. They were tired of they didn't have a running game. They manufactured a running game by passing short passes. I mean, I'm not saying that's the right way to win. I'm just saying that's how they won. Now, you might be right. The league caught up to them. But they playmakers. They had playmakers. They playmakers would caught the lead off guard. They playmakers were tight ends. They playmakers were two young tight ends running like gazelles. And nobody had thought about how you're going to stop tight ends because when you move them out, if you move a tight end out with their tight ends, if they move their tight ends out the receiver, out there to the split, now you got to walk a linebacker way out there with them. Well, what Rex said is, I ain't going to walk a linebacker out, I'm going to keep Revis out there. I mean, he realized the playmakers were those big cats with running like gazelles, and he wasn't prepared for that. They still have – that's why I just read it, you saying that they have playmakers. The playmakers, what they realize, they playmakers were these tight ends, these young tight ends who are catching all kinds of passes. How many touchdowns did they catch between them? And very few teams have the personnel to match up with tight ends. Because I think when they played Pittsburgh, I don't know if – was Polamalu there? Did he play? I don't know if he even played in that game.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know how many of these teams, if you look at these teams, how many teams actually have safeties or have people who have guard tight ends.
Yeah.
Not many of them here. And that's where they realized their strength was. And what Rex did was, okay, when you walk these tight ends out here, I'm keeping Revis and these cats out here with them. Every time when Revis is going to go to the inside and cover your tight end, I'm going to take that option away from you. Where are you going to go now? Because you really ain't going to touch. You're not going to try and test him.
So, I mean, I agree with you, but, I mean, I think we both are making some good points.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I can see what you're saying, too. You know, I can see what you're saying, too. You know, I think we just we seeing the same thing. We just seeing it a little bit differently, is all.
But you see, the real we are back in effect. See, this is what happened 2 weeks ago. We didn't even get to half our agenda.
We sure did. It's the last report.
So why don't we just make this an NFL? We might have to make this an NFL Tuesday. And just, yeah. I know we want to talk about coaching changes.
Yeah, let's get into the coaching changes, man. We got Harbaugh in. We got your boy Harbaugh taking over in San Francisco. What do you think about what he needs to do to turn that situation around, to turn that franchise around out there in the Bay?
Well, and I don't know what I was on. I know I had talked about Harbaugh going to Big Blue, and there's a whole bunch of issues we can get into later about why things haven't changed. But, you know, I think in some ways it's turning out to probably be a good situation for – I wasn't as strong on Brady Hoke. So we'll talk about that at some point. But there, I think what he's going to do, what's great about San Francisco when you do an assessment is that on defense, they got some beasts. I mean, they got some good players. And on offense, they got some pieces as well. His biggest question is where I think is his strength in terms of coach is they're going to have to make some decisions about the quarterback position. You know, they got to decide whether or not they want to catch one of these veterans and try and use that because they got a team. And they're in a division, kind of like what you were saying before about Carson. I would say that from a personnel standpoint, San Francisco is probably the strongest team in that division from a clear personnel standpoint. I want to say on the defensive side of the ball and offensive side of the ball, they're just missing the quarterback. You know, he has to decide whether or not they want to draft a young quarterback and then maybe trade to get someone like Donovan or get someone like Carson or get some veteran who can – do something with this group right now while they cultivate a young quarterback. So I think they're so close with the way that division is, you know, if I'm Harbaugh, I'm looking at this like, you know, I get the right quarterback in here and I got a running game. I got running backs who can run. I got an offensive line. I got a great tight end. As he said, like Bo asked him, do you got a guy who can put his hand on the ground? Tight end. You know, he got that kind of guy there. He's got a Pro Bowl type tight end there. He's got a good defense. He's got some linebackers. So he got some pieces there, which I think why it made this job such a great job for him. So his biggest decision is going to be about quarterback. I mean, he's got a receiver and catch. I mean, he's got people, but he's got to make a decision about where he wants to go with his quarterback. And given the personnel and given the division, you know, if they can find a way to get, you know, a solid veteran who can come in and do something with him, if I were him, I'd go for it, you know, and draft a young quarterback. I mean, he was around the college game. There's some quarterbacks in the draft that he could draft that who could sit there and move, unless he thinks he can do something with Alex Smith.
Yeah. I'm looking at Ty McShay's latest mock draft just to see who he kind of had pegged going to them. Let me pull this up real quick. To see what his assessment of as far as need, what he had them going for. I can't remember what. Let's see. Hold on. All right. So, it makes it. And this is Kuiper's, actually. This is Kuiper's mock draft. He has them taking Robert Quinn from North Carolina, the kid who was suspended all season, at the number 7 pick, which. My opinion, it makes sense to me. I mean, stock up on the defense. I mean, at that position, they could get a Cam Newton. They have Cam Newton going at 10. They could also pick up a Ryan Mallett or a Jake Locker, depending upon how he feels about those particular players. You know me, I'm not real high on Locker or Mallett.
I mean, he's had a chance to evaluate Locker because he's in his –
Yeah, he saw him a lot. I mean, he basically saw him grow up.
What about the kid from Missouri? Where they got him going? I mean,
they got him going in top 5. McShay got him going number 3 to the Bills, and Kuiper's got him going. I think Kuiper has him going number 5 to the Cardinals. So, and McShay has the 49ers picking up Marcell Dareus. from Alabama, the defensive end, who I also think is good because he's that 3-4 DN that they need for that scheme that they run if they're going to stick with the 3-4 scheme. But I agree, man. That San Francisco team is probably the most talented team in that division. It's probably the most talented team not to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
Outside of maybe Tampa Bay. But quarterback, and Alex Smith is such a, I mean, he's looked good at times. He's just so inconsistent. He's so inconsistent that I think they need to move on. You know, he keeps showing flashes. He keeps having like a stretch of 2 or 3 games where he looks good. Then he'll have 2 games where he looks terrible. Then he'll get hurt for 4 or 5 games. And you just can't depend on him. You know, whether he's going to develop or not, I think you just need to – that ship has sailed, and they need to move on and move in a different direction at the quarterback position. He could be a solid backup.
I think, you know, one of the things that when you evaluate Alex Smith is you got to evaluate – I used to call this the Cordell Stewart thing that he got impact on because people judge Cordell Stewart. But Cordell, when he was a Steeler quarterback, he had like 4 – that was when the Steelers were going through some stuff. He had like 3 or 4, 5 offensive coordinators in new offices. And I'm like, how do you expect continuity? How do you expect him to grow as a young quarterback where every year you learn a new terminology or new coaches coming in with a new philosophy? And one of the things he's going to have to assess is how much is Alex Smith impacted by these constant changes? And maybe it is a change of scenery. I mean, because I know he doesn't want to make the same mistake as Singletary, but the thing I give Harbaugh is that Singletary was an offensive coach who could do something with Alex Smith. He had to depend on somebody else to work with Alex Smith, whereas Harbaugh is in a position to actually evaluate, because he was a quarterback at the NFL level, he's an offensive guy, to figure out how he could develop this kid. So, I mean, that's one of the things that, I mean, we're such a win-now type of culture, such a microwave type of culture, that when it comes to quarterback play, we're not allowing these guys are coming out of worse offensive training situations than we've ever seen because of the way they run a lot of these college offenses. Now, they're very vanilla. They're very cut the field in half. There are very few quarterbacks who even high school play under center. And so in terms of the preparation to do these things, these quarterbacks may come with a lot of skill and ability. They come with very little kind of training that will prepare you for NFL that's kind of transferable to NFL right now. Yet we want them to be ready sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And that part, and Alex Smith fit that. I mean, that's the kind of offense they played at Utah. So, I mean, we got to be careful with this, and Harbaugh's got to evaluate that. Having said that, if you think he's worth it, let the kid know, look, we love you to be here. We got to do something with your salary. You got to compete, but we got to bring a veteran in. And if you prove you can play, I'm going to let you do it. If not, we're going to drop you and get traded. You know, you might have to set that situation. This is going to be competitive. We're looking to bring a veteran in, and if you demonstrate you can play, I'm going to play you. If you don't, then you're going to be a backup.
Right.
And if he sets that right up front and Alex is willing to take the challenge, that's where you're going to get a sense does he have that competitive fire.
Mm-hmm.
He also got Troy Smith there. I don't know what's going on with him. But he's got some young people. Now, Troy might not be as damaged goods as Alex because Troy is still emerging. But, you know, they're going to have to bring in a veteran if they can find a good deal. I mean, Carson might be a good play out there, too.
Yeah.
But if the Bengals were willing to move him. But, you know, that's one that looks good to me. And who else we got? We got John Fox in what, Denver?
Yeah, John Fox in Denver. And that's an unenviable situation to me. Just because you inherit Tebow. And Tebow is such a polarizing quarterback. You either – and I'm sure the management knew that going in. They had to find a coach who liked Tebow and who's going to be willing to work with Tebow. But I think Fox is a good fit because he's a run-first guy. And – I think Denver, as a franchise, even with Elway there, was at their best when they were a run-first team. That's when they won, you know. And I think with a quarterback like Tebow, if you have a run-first system, I think that helps him. That I think right now in his career, that's going to suit his talents best. So I think bringing in a coach who's a run-first kind of guy is going to be helpful. I think they just have to invest in their O-line a little bit more and then build up their defense. But I think they got some pieces there. I think they got some pieces. They need a culture change. This year, was under McDaniels, it was just total chaos. It was very crazy. So I think having some stability and having some consistency as far as message, as far as being on the same accord with the players, I think they may, you know, depending upon how they fill out their roster, I could see that being a team. Because I think Fox is a good coach. I think the cupboard was bare in Carolina. They had a you know, 4 or 5 year run where they were competing, and I think they weren't able to keep a lot of the guys there that they developed, and injuries. They had injuries to some guys. They lost their quarterback, and I think they were just at a point where it was time for both sides to move on, because it was going nowhere fast. But I actually like that move of picking up Fox in Denver. I think he's going to fit there well. I think he's got a style and a system that'll play well out there.
I think so, and I think in a that's going to be a tough division for them, but it's still in a lot of turmoil. You know, I mean, nobody knows what's happening out in Raider land. I think the most solid franchise right now in terms of at least some stability is Kansas City, and that, you know, even the talent's still in San Diego, but you still don't know what's happening with San Diego. The Chargers are still not consistent. So, I mean, Denver has a chance, you know, in that division. And if they could play defense and start there and develop that kind of philosophy there, I think they got to get back to stability.
Mm-hmm.
I think you said right now, they got at least, and I think Bowen realized that by bringing John Elway in and doing some stuff, they need to stabilize and they need to reestablish the Bronco culture there and what they're all about. And I think they got away a little bit from that, and they need to bring somebody back who's pretty stable. So, you know, I kind of like that as a pickup as well. And I think Fox, like you said, I think Fox needed just a change of scenery. I think he had run his course in Carolina, and with all the injuries with Steve Smith and all the other stuff that happened, I just think that, you know, it was time for him to have a change of scenery. He's still a solid coach.
Yeah, I totally agree. Who else got a new coach this offseason? Jason Garrett in Dallas. I mean, it's a new coach, but it's not a new coach. What do you think of that move of them sticking with Garrett?
You know, given who the owner is and given with the contract negotiations coming up and all that with the league, and given how he finished the season, you know, he's a Cowboy guy, grew up in the system, you know, a lot in terms of being a player there. I think it's a good move for them. I mean, they need stability. He seems like he's a pretty stable guy, and he's energetic. I think he's good for them, and he's not a big name, which I think is, I mean, he's a big name in some ways, but he's not a big name. You know, I don't think, you know, I think they need to stabilize that culture a little bit. And he's someone that Jerry Jones believes in and has liked for a long time. So I think he's going to give him more time to do what he needs to do. It's almost like Jerry hired his favorite son.
Mm-hmm.
He's always wanted to give him this job. And for some reason, I feel like that might be a good thing for him, because that'll make him a little bit more patient and not as much. I don't think Jerry's perceived as being a knee-jerker reaction. He's not. I mean, he's never really fired a guy in season. He's never been that way. But I think, I'm not going to say he's going to be more hands-off, but I think he's invested so much in him, he's going to try and do what he can to allow him to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is the best defense against what might be his weaknesses. So for some reason, I think this is probably the best pick he can pick, you know, and do it, aside from bringing Jimmy Johnson back.
Okay. And you know, this is, I kind of saw this as kind of I view this as interesting that they kept him. You know, I agree with a lot of the points you made. I think it was a smart decision to keep him. But I also was watching to see what Jerry Jones did as far as his coach. There are certain owners and teams that I'm kind of paying attention to as to how they're going about. Like, I'm paying attention to this Peyton Manning deal. Because there are certain teams and owners that are senior owners, senior organizations in the league that I think have an ear to how this whole – or have a lot of insight into how this whole lockout situation is going to play out. And it's interesting to see moves that the Patriots are going to make with Kraft being the owner. The Colts are trying to lock up Peyton Manning real quick. You know, the Cowboys sticking with Garrett. You know, watching these kind of power teams, these teams with owners who these tenured owners who have been in the league for a long time, watching how they maneuver with free agents and how they operate can give us a little bit of insight into how they at least think the negotiations are going to go, whether or not there's going to be a lockout. And I think that also played a part in, as you said, that also played a part in Garrett getting an opportunity to keep that job, which also leads me to think that Jerry Jones may be thinking, you know, this may be a lockout, and we may be coming into a lockout year. So if this is the guy I want, I need to get him now, and we need to, you know, start to plan for how we're going to operate in case we have a short camp, in case, you know, things don't go on the traditional off-season calendar. I want a guy in place who has a system, knows the players, knows what we have on our roster, given that we're not going to have a lot of time to incorporate new pieces. He needs to be familiar with what we already got.
Because that's the kind of season you can steal a championship.
Right.
That's the fair team can steal one. That's what I say, like in fantasy basketball, where you can make some things is during Thanksgiving or Christmas week where there's short games. If you can do some strategy,
yeah,
you can win 13-1 or lose 13-1. But the best prepared team can sometimes come out of something like that and be in a position to win a Super Bowl because you really manage that experience better than any other team, which I think he sees that as an opportunity. You know, but you might be right about how that might relate to them.
Yeah, it's just something that I'm trying to keep a little bit of little track on just to see who's signing who and who's leaving who available and all of those things, because I think it will give us a little bit of insight as to, you know, what some of these owners on some of these kind of power teams think as far as how things are going to play out. What other teams made moves as far as coaches? Washington State, Pat, Oakland. Man, it's always a tire fire out there, man. I don't even, you know, Al at least didn't bring out the overhead projector at this press conference.
But he did spend time talking about why he fired the previous coach while he was introducing the new coach.
Right, which is what he does, man. He just got it, man. Somebody got to figure out what to do with that old man. Somebody got to figure out how to relieve him of his responsibilities. And it seems like they've started to do that slightly. Somebody needs to take it a step further and just go ahead and tell him, man, we got this. Just fall back.
He's going to struggle. It seems like Mike Holmgren hired his little brother, Pat Shermer. So Mike is like, I don't have the time to do the day-to-day coaches. I just want to ask somebody I can talk to from the get you to do what you need to do.
Oh, man.
Well, this has been a good night, man.
Yeah, it's been a very good night. And, you know, we like being back, and we're going to have more. We're going to get into some more things. We had a whole bunch of stuff that we needed to get into, but, you know, it's been a minute. Like I said, it's been a long time. We shouldn't have left you, so we had to get caught up on that NFL talk, man. So, you know, next week, who knows, we'll have a few more things. We still got to touch on Carmelo's situation.
We're going to talk about the Russians.
Oh, yeah, the Russians said, this is too much. This is too expensive. We cannot do this anymore. I love it, man. I love it, man, and how that's all going to play out. He's taking a different approach than LeBron. I still think he's going to get the same result. He's burning bridges as he goes about this, man. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, man. And again, is this trend going to continue? I mean, we already hearing the talk about the 2012 free agent class. of Dwight Howard and Chris Paul and those type of players talking about what they want, and Darren Williams talking about what they want to do and what they need the organization to do. So, I mean, it's going to be crazy, but we're going to get in all that next week. And we got about 10 seconds. D, why don't you go ahead and give your final shout-out and close out the show.
Hey, I'm going to say this. We got to stop burning them jerseys. Denver, put them Carmelo jerseys down. Put them down. Get that lighter fluid. Put it down. I'm burning them jerseys. Put a five next to them. Turn that one into a four or five or something.
There you go, man. Just get a sewing kit, man. It's sewing a new number. That's all. No, you ain't got to burn it. You ain't got to burn it. It ain't that serious. Well, all right, it's the Real Sports Guys. We're signing off for the week. Y'all have a blessed week, and we'll catch y'all next Tuesday, 10 to 12, on Real Blog Talk Radio.